So again, as we were seeing, analytic functions have this very particular behavior that if we know them in some regions, we basically know them everywhere. And they have this nice property that in particular, if you know them in a segment of line, then we can continue them, which is called, this is what is called analytically continuation. We can analytically continue the function and get to know the function elsewhere. I find it really striking. Suppose you start with a function, I give you a Lorentzian, 1 over x squared plus 1. I can even normalize it, but I will probably not normalize it properly. 1 over pi, I think, is a normalization for the integral to give 1. Or it is, yeah, it's okay. This is some function which looks like this. Suppose I pick instead e to the minus x squared with a good normalization again, which would be, in this case, 1 over pi to the 1 quarter, right? As you saw, the integral. No, e to the minus x squared is square root, yeah. With 1 over square root of pi. This function looks more or less the same. Maybe a bit more picked, but whatever. It looks more or less the same. Now let's pick a segment. Let's pick some segments, say, from here to here. This will be our A, our B, from here to here. We would have this segment in the complex plane, A, B. And we would use Cauchy equations . We were just given the value of the function in that segment. I repeat, we are not given the fact that the function is this analytically. Otherwise, we know the function everywhere. We are just given this bunch of numbers, this data on these points. And now I use Cauchy equations to know what's the value of the function everywhere else. The functions look very similar. A priori, if I just plot this data, I have no way of knowing which is which. And I have no reason to expect that this function might become singular when I continue to analytically continue. But this is what happens. I pick the function, let's call this B and A. I pick the case B, and nothing special happens. I just analytically continue. And here at this point, I get something perfectly regular. But if I pick case A, and I'm analytically continue, at this point, which will be the point x equal to I, the function explodes. F of z as a pole. So if I start computing the imaginary part and using Cauchy equations to know them more, up, I see that the imaginary part is growing and it's eventually going to get a pole here, which is where I know that the function has a pole when z is equal to I. So I analytically continue two seemingly equal functions, very similar functions. I just have some data, I see, to a Gaussian and a Lorentzian. A priori, with a naked eye, I cannot even distinguish between them. I analytically continue with the computer by computing these dx's, dy's, and moving up. And at some point, I find that if I start with case A with a Lorentzian, I hit a pole. Suddenly, a pole develops. If I start with case B, which is just a Gaussian, nothing special happens, and there are no poles in the complex plane. So it's really something quite remarkable, and it's a funny exercise to do it yourself, to pick some function, discretize the function, pick the function in a small interval, and then use the Cauchy equations to analytically continue and to see how the function behaves in a complex plane. It's really a fun exercise to see these poles appearing, and you can now analytically continue functions whose exact form you don't know. Say, the wave function of the anharmonic oscillator, and you want to know how it behaves in a complex plane. And you know, you solve numerically in the real axis, you pick an interval, you start evolving, and you try to wonder what are the kind of singularities in the complex plane of the wave function of the x to the 4 anharmonic oscillator. What could it be? And there you don't have an idea, you cannot anticipate a priori because you don't have an analytic formula for the function. However, you know it's analytic. So you know it in a segment, you continue, and the function is what it is by the evolution. Yes?
How fine do we need? How many data
do we need? We need to know. Okay, so of course we need to know this at many, many points to be able to estimate with very good precision the derivative. And then as we go up, we are losing precision, right? So, of course, if we want to go very far away, we need a lot of precision. For example, in this case B, we will need exponentially many points because we know that the behavior of this function is exponential. So it starts behaving exponentially badly when we go up to the complex plane, so we will need exponentially many points. In this case, not so many. It depends on the function. What we will do is we discretize a bit, we evolve, and we discretize with more points and evolve, and the two evolutions should be the same. If they are not, it means that I did not pick enough points to start with. Yeah?
Can you
Yes.
And when the function goes up like that, can you tell what order singularity it is?
I can. I multiply by z minus I, and if it goes to a constant, it's a simple pole. If not, I multiply by z minus I squared, and I plot, and I see the fit, and I see what kind of pole it is. Okay. Good. So, I want to consider now a physical... maybe before considering that physical application, I want to emphasize one more thing. So, Cauchy equation... So, if you have a given function of z, you can draw in the complex plane the lines where u is constant and where v is constant. Okay. And Cauchy equation tells you that these lines are orthogonal. So if you have here, these lines are the lines where u is constant. This would be the lines where v is constant. And they intersect at 90 degrees. These ones are the lines where v is constant. Okay? Now we can consider a map, if you want, of this space, x and y, okay? We can map it, we can have some maps which changes these lines. Now what I want to emphasize is that if you consider a function f of z, and if this map amounts to replacing f of z by f of some h of z, that is, you transform z by an holomorphic function. So this map that z goes to z prime, which is some holomorphic function of z, some analytic function of z. Then, in this way, I get another analytic function. I can call it, say, g of z. And because it is an analytic function, the lines will again be orthogonal. Right? So holomorphic maps, this is what's called an holomorphic map. Can be seen in this language as maps which trivially produce, which start with some harmonic functions, and trivially produce other harmonic functions. And actually these maps, these harmonic maps, they have a nice property that if I pick, say, a small triangle in the z-plane, and I apply this h of z, I get another triangle. After applying it, but the angles are preserved. So, basically what I want to tell you by these pictures is that holomorphic maps, you will often encounter the name instead of holomorphic map. We can also call it conformal map because it preserves these angles here. The size of the triangle will change typically. For example, if z goes to z square, we saw that r goes to r square, so it is changing sizes of circles, for example. But the angles are being preserved. It's something that you can work out. It's a consequence of Cauchy equations. So z going to h of z is a transformation which typically blows up and scales shapes locally at each point, preserving the angles. And this is what an holomorphic map is. Yes? That derivative, yeah, let's... the derivative is non-zero, yes. So that the map is injective, close to the point, yeah. Yeah, someone in the notes asked for more rigor. I don't want to know who, but as you will notice, I will be everything but rigorous throughout the course. I apologize, but if I start putting epsilons, I will go basically to epsilon of what I want to, epsilon far of how much I want to do. So I will be everything except rigorous. I will be completely sloppy. So if you are, but do ask questions. I mean, do ask as you did. How did you, what do you mean if the function has no derivative? Of course, close to the origin, if I want to think of a map, I want to have an inverse. I want to say, okay, this was mapped to this, and I know I can go back and trace back the points. And for this to happen, the map needs to be at least linear, needs to be injective. So two neighboring points must be mapped to two different points. So the derivative must be non-zero, which was what Trevor was saying. Good. So let me emphasize again that given some harmonic function, we can get another harmonic function. So let me write it in a very explicit way. So I start with some f of z, which is u of x and y plus I v of x and y. These are harmonic functions. Then we go to z going to h of z. Okay? Which, if you want, is our z prime, which is equal to some, if you want, big x of small x and y plus big y of small x and y plus I. And therefore, f of z goes to, of course, we know it's an holomorphic function, so there is some capital U of x and y plus I capital V of x and y. This is equal to y because, sorry, not f of z, f of h of z. F of h of z. Because f of h of z is holomorphic. But on the other hand, if we just explicitly replace this, we know that this is nothing but u of capital X of x and y, capital Y of x and y, plus the same thing for v. Okay, so we see that if you give me some map, I know how small x goes to big X, I know how small y goes to big Y, I replace it into my harmonic function, and I generate another harmonic function. So this is how explicitly I pick a small function, u of small x, small y, I get a big u of small y, x, small y. Okay. Let me now remind you of a couple of places where harmonic functions, where you have probably seen harmonic functions before. You have seen harmonic functions, I hope, for sure in electromagnetism, maybe in fluid dynamics, and for sure when you consider heat conduction. So let me just remind you. Okay? Not some fancy particle theory example, but... Okay, so an example typically where we find an harmonic function is where nu is equal, so let's consider a few examples of harmonic functions to motivate the problem that I will try to solve not only but also using Mathematica. So u can be v, an electric potential. Right? So the electric field is the divergence of V. Okay? And when the curl of E is equal to zero, which is what happens if we are in a static situation where the magnetic field doesn't change, okay? This implies together with divergence of E equal to zero, which is what happens in the vacuum where we don't have sources, these two imply precisely that nabla square of V equal to zero. So V is an harmonic function. Okay? Another example, U equal to a temperature. The heat flow, in this case, would be proportional to some constant kappa, which we call conductivity, times square of t. Sorry, no, now of t. And the conservation of energy tells you that the derivative with respect to time, the energy in a small element, which is rho c times t, so this is energy in a small square, is equal to the flux on that square, which we saw was the divergence of the heat flow, and the heat flow is this, so it's kappa Nablo square of t. Okay? So again, if we are in a static situation, we get, again, that Nablo square of t equal to 0. So again, Nablo t of square equal to 0 is the statement that there is no, that everything is static and there is no energy getting out of or in of elements. And it can also be, this maybe some of you never saw, phi, which would be what we would call the velocity potential. Okay? Which arises in fluid dynamics when the fluid is divergence and circulation fear free. For divergence and curl free. Okay? So in this case, the velocity is the, because it's curl free, it's the divergence of some field phi. And because it's curl free, we have Nabla times v equal to 0. There are no vortices. And this implies again that phi is a harmonic function. Okay? Any questions here? Just reminding you a couple of examples where we find harmonic functions in physics. So what we have seen so far, the fact that just by holomorphic functions, we pick some harmonic function and generate another harmonic function, can be very useful because if we know how to solve some physics problem, some electromagnetism problem of some potential with some conductor, we can use complex analysis to generate solutions to other physics problems. Right? And if we know the velocity of some fluid in some trivial situation, then we can apply an holomorphic map and get what is the profile of the flow of the fluid in a very non-trivial situation. Right? So complex analysis can be used as a very powerful tool to solving non-trivial physics problems. So let's consider an example, which is called the Poisson problem. How many of you have know what the Poisson problem is or have solved or what's the Poisson problem? Uh-huh. Okay, so then it's a good time to see it for the first time. So the Poisson problem asks the following thing. Suppose I have a circle and I fix the electric potential in a piecewise way on this circle. Okay? Or the temperature. Let's think of the temperature. It's funnier. Now you can choose your favorite example. So suppose in a piecewise way I fix my temperature. Here's some T naught, here's some T1, etc. Some T2 here. I fix my temperature in a piecewise way. Okay? And I want to ask myself, what is the temperature at a point here? Okay? I want to be able to predict what would the temperature at a given point be. Ideas. So this is a real life experiment, right? I pick some plates, I fix the temperature on the boundary of this, I fix the temperature in a piecewise way, I impose that here I have T0, T1, T2. If you want to think of electric potential, I fix the potential here, I have some metal and I fix here T0, T1, T2, and I want to know the electric potential inside. Okay. So how would you solve this? Of course not you. So can you think of some warm-up, some simpler case where we might know how to solve it?
Straight line.
Sorry? Straight line, for example. Yeah, that would be easier. Yeah, that's a way of doing it. Yeah, you solve the problem in a straight line, which is much simpler, and then you use an harmonic map to map the straight line to the inner circle, to the circle. That's good. Let's try to do it something different. We know what's the temperature here at the origin, at 0, 0. This you know. Because the temperature is an harmonic function, and the value of the temperature at the origin of this oven is just equal to the average of t on the radius r. It's an harmonic function, t, so I can measure its average, and the temperature is the average of this t0, t1, t2. Average, of course. If there was just t0 and t1, each one occupying half of the circle, this would be t0 plus t1 over 2. So we will have some harmonic function which will approximate these boundary values as we approach the boundary, and which is harmonic inside. So we know that this t of 0 and 0 is equal to the integral d theta over 2 pi from 0 to 2 pi of t of theta. Now, this is of course an abuse of notation, but I think it's obvious for everyone what this means. This means t at the boundary for a given angle t. Okay? So this is, of course, t of r cosine theta, r sine theta. So this we know. So we know the value of the harmonic function in the center. But we want to know it in some other point, a, say, which is not equal to the origin. How would we know the value of t at a? Okay. So let's do the following. If it's not at the origin, let's find an harmonic map which maps A to the origin. When A is at the origin, we know how to solve the problem. Okay? So let's try to follow this logic. So our goal now is let's try to find h of z. We should have two properties. One is that A, such that, let's find this map and then be rigorous about what we do with the map. But for now, it's clear that this map should be useful, so let's just find it. A map such that A is mapped to the origin, and such that the circle, the points in the circle, are mapped to points in the circle. We want to keep this, because we know that for circles we have this property here. So what we want to do is to find a map which maps this point A to the origin and shuffles these points. I mean, I don't know, this goes to this, this goes to this. Points in the circle go to other points in the circle. I don't care which, provided each point goes to a new point in the circle. Circle should be preserved, but what's important is that this A is mapped to the origin. Okay? So this is the map we want. Okay? Now, to proceed, let's say that r is equal to 1. We can always measure distances in units of the radius of the oven, right? So r is equal to 1. So we want, I mean, if not, we can put r's everywhere if you want, but I would rather put r equal to 1 if you don't mind. Please tell me if I'm writing too low here. Whenever you cannot see anymore, warn me. So let's set r equal to 1 and find such map h of z. So the first thing which comes to our mind, if we want to find such map, if we want a to be mapped to the origin, let's try the map z minus a. Right? Z minus a clearly is a good candidate. Right? Now z minus a maps a to 0. Is it good? Yeah, just shifts. So it doesn't map the circle to itself. It's not mapping points to the circle to points in the circle. So what we can do is, so what we want is the following. We want that h of z, when z is e to the I phi, should be a phase. Right? So absolute value of h at e to the I theta should be equal to 1. This is what tells you that h is also in the circle. This is what we want. Right? Recall that this is our z prime. And this is our z. So it tells you that z, whose absolute value is 1, is mapped to z prime, whose absolute value is still 1. Right? Now, this map, the absolute value at the unit circle, is not is not 1. So the a simple way of generating phases is to divide something by its complex conjugate. If you divide something by its complex conjugate, for sure you generate a phase. So let's divide by the complex conjugate. Now what's the complex conjugate? Here is minus a bar. And here, what's the complex conjugate of z? What's the complex conjugate of z? Now, naively, you might say z bar. Z bar is certainly the complex conjugate of z. Z is x plus iy. Z bar is x minus iy. But we want an holomorphic map. Z bar is not holomorphic. If I use a map which involves z and z bar, I'm not using an holomorphic map. Right? So I want it to be complex conjugate only at the unit circle. So at the unit circle, I don't need to use z bar. At the unit circle, I have e to the I theta. And what is the complex conjugate of e to the I theta? E to the minus I theta, which is 1 over z. So at the unit circle, the complex conjugate of z is 1 over z. Okay? So z complex conjugate is equal to 1 over z at the unit circle. This is why I set r to 1. Otherwise, I would have now some factors of r. Otherwise, I would have some r squared there. Now, this might not be completely, you might not be completely happy because there will be a pole when z is equal to 0. This looks a bit singular, right? So let's multiply it by 1 over z. And this is to make it regular at z equal to 0. And it doesn't spoil the requirement that the absolute value is 1 because at the unit circle, z is itself a phase. So the absolute value of this expression is 1 times 1. So it did not spoil the property that the absolute value was 1 because at the unit circle, z itself is a phase. And it is now a regular map. So we found our map. So h of z, can you still see if I write here? Can you or not? Z minus a over 1 minus z a bar. This is what is called, it's a particular case of what is called a Mobius map, a Mobius transformation. I encourage you to Google Mobius to learn something fun about it, if you want.
I just understand what you mean by making it regular. And
when z approaches 0, you see, here I have a pole. When I multiply by z, I no longer have a pole when z goes to 0. Right? So it's better behaved when z goes to 0. Actually, it's not important. I don't need to do it, but I prefer to do it. And I can do it because I make the map regular, but I don't spoil what I had before, which was that it was a phase at the unit circle. It still is a phase at the unit circle because that extra factor is itself a phase at the unit circle. Okay? So we are basically done. So what happens is that this h of z, which is equal to z prime, right? It's a map from z to z prime. When I write in polar coordinates, when I write what it means for theta, it implies some map which maps points in theta to points theta prime of theta. Right? And now, the value of t at a, okay, is the value of t just 1 second. Just give me 1 second. Okay. So t A is now equal to the integral d theta over 2 pi of the average of the new function t of theta prime of theta. Right? Because now this function t of theta prime of theta is, by what we have seen, another harmonic function. And now A is at the origin. Okay? So what is this? This is integral, this is equal to the integral, d theta prime over 2 pi, from 0 to 2 pi, d theta d theta prime t of theta prime. And this d theta over theta prime, using h, you can compute. Let me write what the result is. It's 1 minus absolute value of a square over e to the I theta minus a absolute value again square. Okay? So in this way, we arrive, can I erase this? Non-complex. We arrive at Poisson formula, which tells you that the temperature at a given point A, or the electric potential in at a given point A, T of A is equal to the integral from 0 to 2 pi d theta over 2 pi 1 minus absolute value of A square over e to the I theta minus A square times T of theta. Okay? So if you know T, if you know this this function T here, in the boundary, you know the function t at any value. Okay? So let's compare this with for an analytic t of z, right? This is for an harmonic t of t. This is if the function is harmonic. We saw that for averages, the average on the circle is equal to the value at the origin is true for analytic and harmonic functions. But the value of at the generic point A is not. For an analytic function, it was much simpler. It was just integral dz over 2 pi I t of z over z minus A. This was t of A. And this is what we were getting for an analytic function. For an harmonic function, that is the generalization. And this is Poisson's formula. Okay? Let me just tell you before we go to Mathematica to compute this integral for in some cases. Let me just tell you a nice geometrical interpretation. So now you can try to see how are these points on under that map, what are these points mapped to? Where are these points mapped to? Okay? You pick some points here, where are they going? Because what this map tells you is, if you have this map, if you want to know the value at some point A, find what is the map, which maps how the points are mapped, and compute the average after this map. Right? So, and the final result, if you care, if you think what the map is geometrically, it turns out to have the following nice geometrical interpretation. If you have some, which is something that we can do, if we are camping and we want to know the temperature at a given point, this is something that you can really do without anything. So what you do is the following. You pick your circle, and you map a given point A. And then you have some temperature, say, for example, from here to here you have some T naught, and on the rest you have some T1. Let me paint it in yellow. Okay? Now, what you do is the following. You pick the lines which start from here and go through this point A. Okay? Let's draw it again. You have the point A, you have this line, and you have this line. This is the point A. And you flip this region, you exchange this region with this region. So what you now get is that all this part here is still yellow. That part we do nothing. Now this part is yellow, and this is still yellow. And this is now T naught, and all this part is T1. Okay? And T, the temperature at this point A, is equal to the average of the temperatures in this new distribution. Okay? So if you want to know the value of t here, you see this t is close to this this yellow part. Suppose this was the hot plate and this was the cold plate. You expect it to be hot. And indeed, the average on this new distribution, you see, it's mostly hot and just a bit of cold. And if I would put this point closer to the cold spot, I would redo this procedure, and I would find that it would be mostly cold instead of mostly hot. So again, what we did is we pick this part here, we pick this part here, and we exchange them. And then take the average in the new distribution. So if you want, this is the geometrical meaning of the map that we have seen. I'm not telling you how each point is mapped. I'm telling you that this region is mapped to this region, and these two regions are still left invariant by this map, which is something that you can check. Now, point by point, it's more complicated. A point is not mapped along a straight line to an opposite point or something like this. But as regions, this is what happens. So this is, if you want, the geometrical meaning of Poisson's formula, which is something that you can do when you are camping. Yeah?
Here?
No, sorry, the top right-hand corner on the scoreboard. Here? Yeah. This is for an analytic function, not
for an harmonic
function. Yeah, but shouldn't you actually have the... I'm just recalling. Compare with, this is versus what we had seen before for analytic function. The temperature is not an analytic function. The function of x and y is not an analytic function. It's an harmonic function. So the temperature doesn't obey this. This is what an analytic function obeys. The temperature is harmonic. It's a more complicated class of function. The temperature obeys this.
Okay. Sorry, you can write that as a contraintegral.
I can write it as a contraintegral as well, right? But then with absolute values, so it's not an holomorphic contraintegral.
No, but it would look like that, but we're negative.
Okay, very good. So I will write this as a contraintegral next time. Sorry. So it can be written as the real part of something very similar to this. Okay? So I can, if you want to write this in a way similar to this, I believe that the way to do it is the following. T of A is the real part of the integral, the contour integral, around this absolute value of z equal to r, dz over z, z plus a over z minus a, t of z. Okay? This would be the, I think it's correct, but tomorrow I will give you the correct formula. But I think this will be the correct generalization. This is what I will get for an harmonic function. Again, this is for harmonic. This T is harmonic. Okay. I have plenty of time, right? So I can still expand a bit on this. Yeah, I have infinitely many. Yeah.
Why do we need the function to be piecewise? Can it be just a continuous function?
Yeah, it can. Okay.
I don't understand how you got the. Okay, you added hz.
Sorry?
You found hz, but then in the integral for t, you had 1 minus absolute value of a squared over the absolute value squared.
Okay. So from here to here, the check of this statement I will do in a few minutes in mathematical. So we will see that I did no mistake. Or if I did, we will see what is the correct formula. Okay? So I'll show you how to do this. You recall this was nothing but d theta prime d theta, which we can read from this map, since this is just d prime. But the precise, just like a bunch of algebra which is boring, we will do it in mathematical. Okay, so good. So given that we know that T of A is the real part of this, right, as Callum asked me to write, it seems that we can therefore and we also know that T is an harmonic function. So we know that there exists a function F of Z which is equal to T of Z, T of X and Y, plus I V of X and Y. Okay? This T is what was before our U. We saw it. We also saw that this V was unique up to a constant. Right? It was unique up to a constant, we saw. It means that if I give you what is f of z, you should be happy. You shouldn't complain, oh, maybe there's another one. No, if I tell you what is f of z, you should be happy because given the real part, the imaginary part is unique up to a constant. So let me give you what is f of z. F of z is equal to an integral dz over z, z plus a over z minus a, times u of z, where this means u and the circle. And this is what f of a point a is. Why is this? Because if t is the real part of f, then if I define this function f, this function has that real part, right? I just take the real part, I get t, and I get real part of that, which was what we found. So that this function is an analytic function of a, it's a function of a, and it has the good real part. So it is unique. So this is another remarkable fact. I give you only the real part of an analytic function, not even the imaginary one, I just give you the real part in a circle. And you tell me what the function is everywhere. Right? So this is, if you want, an analytic function from the ashes of just the real part. This is really something remarkable. This is what is called a dispersion integral. This kind of integrals. And this particular formula is called Schwarz formula. Now, is the solution to the Poisson problem unique? Is the solution to this problem unique? How would we know if it's unique or not? So, this is another thing that often in physics we have to ask ourselves. We found a solution. Is the solution unique? Is the problem well defined? And especially when we have some dualities and correspondences, for example, this appears in ADS-CFT, which you might have heard about, we often need to know, is the solution unique? Some field equation. So is the solution T of A unique? Okay? So, first of all, we know that our physics, from our physics intuition, we would say yes. I mean, I fix the temperature of the plates, and then I wait till it stabilizes. Of course, it's unique. I'm going to repeat the experience tomorrow. I'll get the same result. So, of course, it should be unique. How do we see it in a more rigorous way? Well, to see it in a more rigorous way, let's show another remarkable fact about complex sums. Let this be whatever. Let this be u of x and y, which is equal to the real part of an analytic function f of z. And let this be x and y. And let's consider the function, which can be, for example, something like this. Okay? Some function like this. Okay? This would be some function. This would be the values. These here are the values of u at the boundary. Right? And now the statement is that the values of u inside this region R, the values of u inside R, are smaller or equal to the maximum of u on the boundary of R, and are bigger or equal to the minimum view on the boundary of R. Okay. In other words, there is no maximum view inside any region. So you give me an harmonic function. I pick some particular region. There is no maximum inside. The maximum is always on the boundary. The minimum is always on the boundary. Okay? So complex functions don't have maximums or minimums. Okay? How would you prove this? Any suggestions? Okay. So this is the same as saying that U has no max or minimum inside R.
If you say, let's say the minimum is inside the boundary.
Okay. So, exactly. Good.
And then you can take a circle around it, and it could be the average of all the points on the circle.
Absolutely. So suppose there is a maximum inside R. We pick that point, which is the value of the maximum, and we consider the average of the function at some circle around that point. Now, because this point is a maximum, the average around that point is smaller than the value of u at the origin. This would be zero, right? Because the point is a maximum. So if I take the average around, I went down because it was a maximum. So now the average on the point around is smaller than the point. This is impossible. We know that average. We proved before that the average of an harmonic function is the value of the harmonic function. So there can be no maximum. Okay? Good. So how does this help us? Because now, suppose I found two solutions to the Poisson problem. So let T and T prime be two solutions to the Poisson problem. Okay? Now T minus T prime, which is, let's define it as phi, okay, is equal to zero at the boundary. Right? Because at the boundary, by definition, t and t prime have the same values. That was the Poisson problem. Find t and t prime, which behave like this at the boundary. So t minus t prime are zero at the boundary. Right? That means that phi inside the boundary is small, and if phi is an harmonic function, it's the difference of two harmonic functions. It's smaller or equal than zero, and it's bigger or equal than zero, which is the maximum and the minimum at the boundary. So phi is equal to zero. And therefore, the solutions are the same. Good. So, questions? And let's now go to the second part where we got the mathematics. Okay. I think this takes some time to fix. Sorry. Can I lower it?
You
just
put it down
to the but I realized that probably I was supposed to do it yesterday. Yes.
I just, for some reason, it's not quite clear to me why there can't be an extremum inside the boundary. Can you just, like, repeat that?
If there was an extremum, suppose there was an extremum, yeah. Right? So the function close to that extremum, this is what it is, right? There is a maximum, and then this is how it looks close to the maximum, right? So now compute the average of the function here.
Oh, so you just pick any circle
you
around
it? You pick a maximum and compute, and pick a circle around it and compute the average. Now, the average here is smaller than that value. But that's impossible because we know that the average around any point is equal to the value at the center. So such point cannot exist.
So both the minimum and the maximum have to be in the boundary.
Yes. So there can be no minimum or maximum inside. So there can only be what are called saddle points, which are something like you have your function, and if you follow one line, it looks like a minima, but if you go in the other direction, it falls like it looks like a maximum. So what can exist are saddle points, which are something that looks like this. Which are values that, when seen in one direction, it looks like a function is a minimum in this direction, and it's a maximum in this direction.
But that thing you drew there, that like hat-shaped thing, cannot actually be one of our functions.
It can. It has no minimum or maximum inside.
No, the one below that.
This one, no.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. So you can never find this if you plot the real part of a function, of an analytic function. You will never find such thing. Okay. I don't know, maybe I would suggest that you also turn off some non-linear computers and some of the things we can try to do. This is not okay for sure. Why is it not giving my computer and giving some? It's giving the Windows one.
Ah, laptop, not PC, sorry.
Good. Okay. So let's suppose that we consider here, let's do the following case. Let's consider the temperature distribution to be the following, to be on the top part of the unit circle. On this part we have 1, and on this bottom part we have 0. We want to consider this situation here. All this part temperature is 1, here temperature is equal to 0. Okay? And we want to compute this integral here. So I'll give you 5 minutes to try to compute this integral in that particular case with mathematics. Okay? And then we will do it. But I just want you to try a bit. Try something. Just 3 minutes. Only 3 minutes.
So if I could have a file.
Sorry?
So if I could have a file. I
didn't understand.
Mathematica has quite a good help file.
Yeah. Just
help file. Okay.
Menu.
Okay, maybe I should do the first one. So the first thing you want to know is how to ask something to mathematics. Say we want to compute 1 plus 1. So let's all write 1 plus 1 and try to compute 1 plus 1. So is someone having trouble computing 1 plus 1? Someone? Everyone was able to compute. So the first thing to realize is that in mathematics you write 1 plus 1. And then to enter, you click shift and then enter. Not enter. You need shift and enter at the same time. So you click shift and then enter. Right? Or if you have two enter keys, one of the enter keys you can click directly, the one which is to the right of the keyboard. Okay? So everyone managed to enter 1 plus 1. Okay? Now, let's say we have x squared. X squared, you would write x, and then this symbol, I don't know how it's called, hat, or whatever. And then a 2, and again you will need shift enter to get an x squared. Okay? Now, this of course is nothing, let's compute, say, the derivative of x squared. So we copy x squared here, and let's compute the derivative. The derivative we enter v, and then x squared comma x. And then we run it, and it gives us 2x. Is everyone here, or is someone already trying to run the previous ones? Okay, good. Now suppose I want to integrate. I run integrate x squared, x squared comma x, just indefinite interval. And this will give me x cubed over 3. Okay? So, any doubts here? So now the first thing we might want to do is to have some reasonable, some slightly better looking notation. So for example, okay, so first thing that I personally like to do is first let's put some style sheets, go to creative, and choose natural color. This is the nice one, I think. So now they look a bit better, at least we have boxes, you know, that these were 3-4 computations, and it always looks nice. The second thing you want to do is to put titles in your worksheets, not to get some huge notebook at the end, which is extremely confusing. Now, style sheets, you can enter some text, say, where we put notation, for example. And then you select a cell here on the right, and then go to cell, or to format, style, and you have many styles that you can choose. For example, title 1, title. And you see, if you are using Windows or Linux, you have some shortcuts instead of Apple 1, for me, or Control 1. You might have something else as a shortcut. Okay? So you click this title, and now it becomes a nice title for notation. And whenever you create titles, the full section gains a bar here on the right. Can you see? I cannot see when I click, so you should tell me. Can you see? There. And when I double-click that bar, it minimizes the section and hides everything. Okay? So this is useful if I have several sections, and then I can minimize by blocks and only open the one where I'm working. And then I double-click again to open.
So could you go over again? How you
write for notation?
No.
Yeah, so I wrote notation. Which format? No, this is format, style sheet, creative, and then I chose natural color. If you want to be scared, you can choose the primary color one. Okay. So, good. Is everyone happy here? So, you can create your subtitle, and then you can create your title. So, you can create basic notation. We can write basic notation. And then convert this cell. We select this cell by using Shift. And now we convert it to any style that we want. And it's very useful to know the shortcuts. So, for me, control 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. give me the several styles. So I just convert, for example, command 4, and I get some style. So it's very useful to get to know the shortcuts to make it much faster. And now I minimize this section if I want by double-clicking there. And I can have basic notation, and here I can have advanced notation, and I can make it also a title by clicking, again, Apple 4. And now I have 2 sections here, and I can write on whatever section I want. Yes?
How do you write in the box?
How do I write in the box? I just start writing. Okay, let's see. Well, how do I write in a box? What's the question?
But it's not in a box. Like you, how do you?
Okay, so now you go down. Okay, so if you want to start writing, if you started writing something in a title, and now you want to write something again in the usual boxes to ask for commands, you just go down, you go to some point where a huge line like this appears, which tells you that you are in some empty spot, and then you start writing. And the box appears. Okay? If you are inside some advanced, if I click enter, I just increase this space. So to start entering stuff, I go to this line here, and I start writing. Okay? Okay, good. So for today, let's not click, create one, let me put some style 5, which is a bit smaller. And let's erase everything else and just start with some basic stuff. So first thing, let's go back to our integral. You don't need to copy, of course, everything I'm writing. Just enter some commands which surprise you or whatever. I might want to integrate this x squared from x. And I might want to integrate rho squared, for example. Rho squared and rho, and it would integrate. And I could integrate rho squared from A to B, and it would give me this. Now, this is awful, I think, right? Or not? So let's write this in a reasonable way. So first, rho. What is rho? Rho is rho. So the way to insert nice characters is by clicking escape. So please, everyone, try this one. Escape, R, and then escape again. Escape, yeah, esc. How is it called? Escape, no? Esc, then R, and then esc again. Okay? And the row appears, right? So you click escape, R, escape again, and we get a row. So this is better. Let's at least replace this row by escape, R, escape, and we have a better thing. So now this looks a bit better than that, right? Okay? Now, we can also use, instead of this row square, we can also use, instead of this integrate, we can also click escape, int, escape, and an integral symbol appears. Okay? And now with the integral symbol, I want to put the limits of integration. Okay? So if you know the shortcuts by hand, you know how to do it, and you just do it. If you don't know, what you would do is you would select this integral sign. You would go to palettes, but these shortcuts that I'm going to show you, I really recommend that you memorize them today. Yeah, otherwise, it's really a pain to always do this. You go to Math Assistant in the palettes, and then you choose, I don't even know which one, probably this one here. Yes. Yeah. And you see that when I select that one, I am told what is the shortcut for it. Okay? And I am told that in my case, it is first control equal to go down, and then control 5 to go up. Okay? So if I click this one, I get two limits, and I can put A, I can put B, and I can then write row square, and then I can say D row. D row is escape, DD, escape, row. Okay? This integral symbol, the first integral symbol was escape, int, escape. If I did not know, again, I could use the palette and use again. For example, a simpler way for those who don't know would be to click some empty line. So go to some empty line, okay? And click just this symbol here. Look here. Okay? Definite integral. You would click here and everything would appear and you would just need to replace whatever you want by what it is. So you would click here in upper and put a B, you would click here and put an A, you would click here and put row square, and the variable you would call it row. Okay? So you would find it here in the Math Assistant with whatever you need to fill it out. Okay? But again, it's very useful if you know the, and if you run it, it does give the good result. And it's very useful if you memorize. So you click int, in my case A, and then B of x squared ddx. And this would give me the result. Yeah. So I don't know in Linux what's the shortcut. The shortcut you learn by seeing here in the math palette, it will tell you what is the shortcut. I think for if it's Linux, it should be... Yeah, control equal, for example, should, if you now are in the... Yeah, let's try. Let me try. Let me go here. Yes. Now you are in. Go to the front of the integral and now click control equal. Okay. And now write A and then control 5. And I write B. So everyone, please try this. Try. Like escape in escape and the integral appears. Now you are in front of the integral sign and type control equal. And now a box appears down, right? No? So let's start again. Escape in escape. Can everyone run this on an empty line? Escape in escape. Then control equal. And the box appears downstairs. And you write A. And now control 5. And the box appears upstairs. And you write B. Did someone not manage to do it? Yeah, so first of all, so let me write everything. First, escape in escape, then control equal, then you write whatever you want, in this case A, then control 5, and you go up. Okay, so escape in escape, int appears, control equal, you go down, you write A, control 5, you go up, you write B. Did everyone do it?
Then how do you get the VX special?
Good. But let me first be sure that everyone did it. Yes? Now, type x squared, x hat 2. And then, for this d, you write scape dd scape. And then you put x. And then shift enter to run. Okay? Everyone's happy. Good. Now, again, we saw control equal to go down, control 5 to go up, but really below and above the expression, not slightly to the right as we are used to. So two more useful shortcuts are these ones here, you see, which is control minus and control 5 again to go up, if you want something which is on top of the minus, and this one which is for the power, which is control 6. So again for x square, let's erase x square and do it properly. Let's erase the 2, and let's again control 6 to go up, and we put the 2, and we do the x square as it should be. Okay, can everyone now please erase the hat 2 and replace it by a nice x square like this? Okay, is someone having trouble, or can I move on? Okay, so let's, one more thing. If you would write integrate, so first let's compare. Let's replace this x here by rho, x by rho. And you can compare the first expression with the one we get now. So this was how we started, and this is how we are now. Okay? So this is clearly better than the previous one. Yes? Control 6. Okay? So try, please. Row and then control 6. So to do this one, you do control 6. You write row, then control 6, and you type 2. Okay. Now, if I would start with this one, okay, at least with row, but suppose I start with this slightly ugly one with row. Then what I can do is I select this cell, and I can go here and say cell convert to standard form. It's already in standard form, but I can convert it again, which means write it in a better standard form. And I will click here, and it will convert automatically to what we have. Okay? So if I write something, let's do it, integrate something, say x from 0 to 1, and then I select the cell, and I go format style, no, sorry. Cell convert to standard form. Okay? So write something ugly and go to cell convert to standard form and see that something becomes something nice in the usual way. So you can write something like this and go to cell convert to standard form. I'm sorry for those who know Mathematica, but it will be important to that everyone knows the very basics. Okay? Everyone managed to do it. Another thing, obviously, this is also another nice shortcut to know. In this case, for me, Shift-Control-N, I don't know what it would be for you. So whenever I write an expression and then I notice this could be somehow nicer, I just select the cell and convert it, and automatically it becomes nice. Right? So I would click here, and this would become an integral like this. Okay, good. So let's now try to do that integral there. Or maybe to try to check how this d theta prime d theta is indeed given by this. Okay. So what do you prefer, the integral or the intermediate step? Someone has some preference, or no one has any preference? Okay, so let's do the integral, which is slightly more advanced and it's a bit funnier. or let's do the integral. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So one more thing about Mathematica, one more very basic thing about Mathematica, which is I will do first the intermediate step. I'm sorry. So we know that at the unit circle, z prime is e to the I h prime, right? By definition of what h prime is. So we know that e to the I theta prime, is equal at the unit circle. This is the map that we want. E to the I theta minus a over 1 minus a bar e to the i theta, right? So, and we have this, and we want to compute d theta prime d theta of this quantity. Okay? So what we can do is we define some z prime, let me call it zp, to be equal to that combination there. So again, I can write exponential of I theta, and again, there are several ways to do it. So first way, let me do it in an ugly way. I write exponential of I theta minus a over 1 minus exponential of I theta times a bar, let's call a bar ab. Okay? Sorry? Theta, again, escape, then t, no, t gives theta, so escape, th, escape. So you see that there are several ways of entering theta. One is escape, th, escape, which is the fast one. Another one is escape, theta, escape. So the obvious one, which is escape, alpha, escape, escape, beta, escape, always works. But there's normally a faster one. So escape, escape gives alpha. So in practice, I don't even know which one works. I just do it automatically. Yeah. Okay, good. So this would be our z prime. And this is how you define something in mathematics. You put an equal sign, and this tells Mathematica that z prime is given by this expression here. So now if I ask Mathematica, what is z prime? She knows what is z prime. Okay? So now z prime was defined to be this quantity here. Now, again, I could use shortcuts to define the first line in a nice way. But if I did it in the wrong way, the simplest way is, again, I select the cell, I go to cell, convert to, and I click standard form again, and it converts to something a bit better, with this fraction written as a fraction. Okay? And you can see how to enter fractions by shortcuts, and you can also do it with shortcuts. Now, one more thing. If you consider exponential of 2, and ask what is the numerical value of this, okay, so a function is applied like this, numerical value of this, it gives nothing, because she doesn't know that this e is the exponential e, right? She doesn't know that this is the Euler number. So the Euler number is either capital E, Mathematica knows what it is, or scape e, scape. Or scape, e, scape, yeah, scape, e, scape. So scape, e, and then scape again. This gives this one here. Okay? And similarly, I, for Mathematica, is the complex number. I square is minus 1. And I also might prefer scape, I, scape, and this she also knows that it's minus 1. But I, of course, she doesn't know. I is a variable. Okay? So once again, for e, we saw that small e doesn't work, capital E works, and slash ee, escape, ee, escape also works. And for I, capital I works, as before, slash ii, escape, escape, ii, escape also works, and nothing doesn't work. So similar to e. Okay? So using this, another way of writing this formula is, instead of this xx, I can click x, ee, escape, then I go up, I, theta, and this looks even a bit better, right? Okay? So this will be maybe the best way of writing it. The more familiar one, that is. Okay? So this is what zp. Is it okay? Can I erase everything else? Is someone still thinking, or...? Okay, you see, the idea is that you get an idea of what you can do. Then you should go and play yourself with it. I will leave the garbage so that you, if you want, you might want to play with it. And let me create a new section. Okay, so this now contains garbage only. Okay. Okay, so here is Z prime. And what do we want to do? We want to compute the derivative of theta prime with respect to theta, right? What is the derivative of theta prime with respect to theta? It's the derivative of Z prime with respect to theta over Z prime, right, times I. Is it clear? This is d theta prime d theta, right? If I take the derivative, is it clear? This is the derivative of log of Z prime, right? So this is the d theta prime d theta. And again, this notation is not perfect. It's okay. So when I compute it, this is what I get. How do I make horizontal line? Okay, again, suppose I did not do it first. Right, first, suppose I did not do it. Then I would have, then I would have this. And what I would do is I would go here, format, cell, convert to traditional form, and she would do everything for me. She would even replace the derivative by this nice curly d theta, you see? So let's see how we would do it now ourselves. So we would have x over y. You click control and then this slash, the slash, control slash, and y. Yes? Yeah, so you just, right, so you have this section. You click on the last line. A line like this appears. And then you can either write and then convert to the new style, or click the shortcut which gives the section style, which I don't know what it is. I think Control-Shift-2. If you just write something, you would write something here and then select it and say format, style, and you would call it a subsection and it will make a new section. So you would write again and try this. Okay, so again, these shortcuts, x over y, you might want to play with it. It's just x, control slash y, and the derivative, if you want, slash partial, this gives a derivative, and then it's control minus, and you can put theta of zp. Okay, so, but if you don't know, just use d of zp comma theta, if you don't want to use these fancy shortcuts. Okay. So, but this is what it is. So, derivative with respect to theta of zp over I zp. And now we want to simplify this. And the mathematics is a function, simplify, which we apply simplify to this. We apply simplify to this ratio here, which is a mess. And this ratio becomes just this. Okay? And this ratio is precisely the same as that. Because 1 minus AA bar is 1 minus the absolute value of A. And then this guy, complex conjugate, is a bar and e to the minus I theta, so it combines with this one here. So it's clear to you that this quantity is the same as this part here, I hope. Yes? Sorry?
What do you mean zero is we have with our in group?
You have something strange. Derivative with respect to what is there?
Theta.
Sorry, because you have I theta without any space between I and theta. So I theta, if you don't put any space, she thinks of it as a variable called I theta. And the I that you use, you should use this either capital I, which is the safest, or escape, I escape. So did everyone manage to get this as a simplification of derivative of Z prime with this, over Z? So everyone, please try to get this when you compute.
This is correct, right?
No, you don't have space between I and theta. This is a variable.
You need space.
You need a space. Okay? So when you define Z prime, some people are not putting a space here between this I and this theta. You need a space. Otherwise, it's the variable I theta. So you need a space between I and theta. I just want to enter ZP and compute this d theta d theta prime, which is indeed given by that. Is it? Okay, while you try, before I forget, I want you to, at the end of this one, I want you to do another one. I'm sorry. Can you give it to your
colleague?
In the integral?
The integral on the board.
Okay. So you are saying that this expression doesn't seem to be the same as this one.
Yes.
No, but it is, because notice that in the denominator, you don't have the absolute value of that. So this guy, if you take the complex conjugate to get the absolute value that you have there downstairs, A goes to A bar, and this guy goes to minus I theta. So you have to absorb this guy here to make it the absolute value of this one here. So it does, this is exactly the same as that. Okay? Can you hand out five there? Yes. Yes, because you didn't leave a space between I and theta, so for Mathematica you have a variable I theta. Now it will work. Yes? Why are you getting zero? It's again the same story. You are not many people are not leaving a space between I and theta. For Mathematica, I theta would be a variable. She would think of I theta as a variable. Like you can call A bar. A bar, this AB is not A times B, it's A bar, right? It's a variable, it's a single object.
Can we do A, C prime and A bar and stuff like that? You mentioned, right? C prime, A is the bar.
Okay, very good. I will, that's a more advanced question, actually, even though it doesn't seem so. So can you distribute this 5? Can you distribute this 4, please? For you. Eduardo, can you distribute this 4? Can you distribute, sorry, please, this 4? Does everyone have one? Okay, so is someone not getting this? Everyone got this? Are you writing I theta with space between I and theta? The form. Ah, sorry. I have 3 only, but it doesn't matter. As I told you, I just want to have an idea, so just do it in pairs or whatever.
Can you help me fix this?
Yes, so you got it. It's okay. So now you want to simplify it. So you didn't have to simplify yet. So you want to write simplify of that so that Mathematica simplifies it. Now, someone asked me a very good question about why can't we write, we wrote everything in such a nice way, why can't I write A bar and a Z bar and put just a bar on top of the A? And I can indeed, but I don't recommend at all. I recommend that you don't do it. So let's see why. Okay? Suppose I do A bar. So again, I can delete the B, I can select the A, and do the same shortcut which sent us to the top, which is control 7 if you just want to go to the top, and then put a bar. Now this is okay. This one it will work nicely and the expressions look indeed a bit better. Okay? Here it was not dangerous. I just replaced A by this A bar, and indeed I got something nice. And actually I could even do it for Z prime. I could call Z prime. No, Z prime would be trickier. Z prime I could not because she thinks of prime as derivative. But I could call it Z tilde, for example, if I would like. I could call this Z, I could call it Z, again control 7 to go up, and I could put a tilde. And I would have this Z tilde. And again, this would work. So in this example, it was not that bad. Okay? So everything would work nicely, and I would just play with this. Now, it can often be very bad, because suppose we have something like we saw before, 1 over z minus z index j. This is an example, for example. You think that this might be a good idea to denote zj. Let's compare this, which I claim is the bad. Let's define this as being what I call bad. And what I call good, I would say 1 over z minus zj, like this, which you would call ugly. Right? So let's define these two. You see, Mathematica gives the two outputs. If you don't want to see the output, what you do is you put a semicolon at the end. So you put this symbol, and you run it, and it doesn't give the output. Right? So sometimes you don't. If you want to see the output, you remove it. If you don't want to see it, you put it. Now, what's the problem of using the first one versus the second? Can someone tell me? What could be the kind of problems that we would get when having this bad versus the good? Sorry? For example, but that might even be good sometimes. Oh, okay, let me write another. And what I would call the really good would be something like this, for example, z of j. This I would really like. Okay? Now, why is that? Because how does Mathematica, what happens if I take the derivative of good with respect to z? I get minus 1 over z minus zj squared. Right? That's perfect. But what happens if I take the derivative of bad with respect to z? I get this stuff. Why? Because the way Mathematica thinks of z subscript j, so we have this z index j, which seems to be the problem because I called it bad, and we want to know how Mathematica thinks of this expression. So to know how Mathematica thinks of something, you apply to that something full form. And by applying full form, you see how Mathematica thinks of this guy. And Mathematica thinks of this one as a function which is called subscript, which has two arguments. The first is z, the second is j. But now when you take derivative, it means that you take derivative of a function of two arguments with respect to the first argument of the function. And this is what she did here. She took the derivative of the function superscript with respect to the first argument of the function. So she did what you would like to do, because if you would like to write here something like a function of z and j, you want Mathematica to take the derivative with respect to z of this function, right? So this is what you would like to get. And subscript is just a function like f. So you don't have the right to complain with Mathematica, because for Mathematica, this guy and this guy, they are exactly the same. Full form of this is this, and full form of f of z and j is basically the same. It's a function of z and j, another function of z and j. Right? So you take the derivative with respect to z of that function, you get the derivative with respect to the first argument. So this is something which can be very bad when you put these superscripts and then you want to take derivative back to z and you start getting these derivatives of subscripts. Okay? So that's why I called it bad. So this is something that you should keep in mind and understand why it works. Yeah?
How do you render the derivative?
The derivative, it's scape slash partial scape. There should be a faster way, but I don't know. Again, the simplest way is to go to Palette, Basic Math Assistant, and you see all these symbols, and then you go here, and you wait a bit, and it tells you what is the shortcut. Scape, PD, scape. Partial derivative, scape.
But what are we taking the derivative?
Then you take control minus to go down and to put the argument with respect to which you want to take the derivative.
No.
It's a physics question. So what you want is to take the derivative. What we want to compute for this quantity is this. It's the derivative of theta prime with respect to theta, which is the same as the derivative of z prime with respect to theta times 1 over z prime.
Okay.
Oh, with an I. With an I here. Okay? Good. So, finally, and I think for those who know a bit of Mathematica, this can be new, what I'm going to tell next. Let's suppose we want to compute this integral here. Okay? In that situation there. Okay? So now let's call this the integral. Did someone manage to compute it? You did? Okay. So, did someone else manage to compute it? This integral? Let me just see how you did it.
Yeah, but I compute for not general, just for values of
A. Okay, good. So it's very similar to the way I'm going to do. Why? Because you tried the general and it didn't do it.
Yeah.
Okay? So Eduardo faced the usual problem of Mathematica. We write the integral and it doesn't compute. Okay? And that's usual. And that's what you should expect. No, the program is not good. So we just write. Again, let me write. I can write in a nice way immediately. Integral 1 minus A. And then I can write A bar, which will be the conjugate of A. Okay, let's put A bar. Over absolute value of exponential of I theta, or let me put in a nice notation, e to the I theta with space, minus A, okay? Okay, this A bar, let me write it, is the conjugate of A, okay? And this, the integral sign, I go here, goes from 0 to pi. Why? Because I said that I want this t to be 1 from 0 to pi and 0 everywhere. So it means that I put the integral from 0 to pi and this t of theta is 1 in that region. Right? So this is what I want to compute. This is what we want. Sorry? Square at the bottom, exactly. Good, thanks. And dd theta. And this is what I want to compute. And I click shift enter and she doesn't give me the result. Okay? Any suggestions for how to proceed? So when Mathematica is not giving the result and it's just waiting and waiting and waiting, we might want to abort and tell stop. I'll do something else. This is another very important command. You go to evaluation. Actually, I did not think, I think that it will never stop, but apparently it works. But let's suppose for some integrals it doesn't stop. You have to wait forever. And we saw that we needed to wait for a very long time. Right? To quit the kernel, you have to abort the evaluation. Where is it? Evaluation. Abort evaluation. Here. Control dot for me. I think for you as well. So if I would run this, and I would abort, I would control dot, and it would abort. Aborted. And this is useful because often we write things, we think Mathematica will compute, and she would think forever, and we need to abort. Okay, very important. Control dot. So how would I do this integral? Actually, how did I prepare this integral? I didn't wait 1 minute to see if it computed or not. If it takes more than 10 seconds, I abort the computation by definition. So the way we can do, and this is a nice trick for integrals, is the following. You do the following. You say that A, okay, is equal. So you want to define what A is. Okay, let me do it in the following way. Let me do it first the way that I would not do it. Let me put here, okay. Let me call it B instead of A. B. And B times B conjugate is absolute value of B squared. The integral, escape. Okay? So suppose I want to compute this. And this Mathematica takes forever to compute. Actually, eventually she finishes, but it takes forever. So I will do the following. I will say B is equal to, and B is a point which is somehow inside the unit circle. Now, very important functions are called zeta functions. Does someone know what a zeta function is? Zeta of 3, this function here. I can evaluate it numerically, and it's this. It's a transcendental number. Zeta 5 is another transcendental number. Zeta functions are the sum from k equal 1 up to infinity of 1 over k, in this case, to the 5. Okay? If I run this, this is the definition of zeta 5. Okay? If I put instead of 5 n, I get definition of zeta n. Okay? Now, odd zetas are boring. If I put z squared, I get pi squares. If I put 4, I get pi to the 4th. So what we do is we use this very particular transcendental functions with even with odd exponent, which gives this zeta 5, zeta 3, etc. Okay? Here you didn't complain. Did you see what I did here? I did slash slash n. Okay? This is another way of doing n of zeta 5, numeric value of zeta 5. This is equivalent. I can put zeta 5 and then say apply to this n, and I put slash slash n at the end. So this and this are exactly equivalent. Okay? So what we do now is the following. Mathematica takes a huge time because she doesn't know if B is real or whatever. So we tell Mathematica, B is equal to, say, 1 over zeta 5 times exponential of I theta times zeta 3. No, times I zeta 3. Okay? And then we compute this integral, which we call int. Oops. And now it's... what happens? Sorry. So we compute, we don't see the output, we put this, and now we compute this integral. And immediately she gives us the result. This is what the result is. And now what we do is very simple. We pick int, and we replace zeta 3 by the angle of B, and zeta 5 by the absolute value of B. And we go, and we replace, this is cheating, of course. We replace zeta 5 by 1 over the absolute value of B, of A, and we replace zeta 3 by the angle which we can call phi. And this is the result of the integral. Now, here we are assuming that when computing the integral, zeta functions don't appear. Otherwise, it might be dangerous. But if we know that zeta functions don't appear, then I can just do this replacement. And for Mathematica, it's much faster because I'm telling her to work with specific numbers, specific values. And I could do, instead of using zeta 5, I would use zeta 7, and I would get here, instead of 1 minus zeta 5, I would get 1 minus zeta 7 squared. And then I would replace zeta 7 by 1 over absolute value of A. And then at the end, I would simplify. Okay? And this would be the result of that integral. So at a given point with some absolute value and some angle, this is what the result would be. Okay? Just 1 second, let me replace this absolute value by some row. And this is what the result would be for the temperature inside the plates. Yes?
How does the syntax work with the replacing
things? Okay, very good, very good.
How do you put int in the front there?
Perfect, yes. Okay, good. So, here I define what b is, then I compute the integral, and then in this integral I want to replace stuff. Okay? So, and this is how it works. If you want to replace something, you put, so if you have x plus y, and x you want to replace by 2, this is how you do. You put x plus y, and then slash dot, which means replace, and then you put the replacement rule, x by 2. So this is how you replace something. Yes?
Whenever I use a row, my calculations, it replaces it with escape squared row, r. Why that's...
When you write row, it replaces by escape.
Okay, I go escape, r, escape.
And no, I will see it at the end.
So what if you do that and your answer is like x plus y plus 4 and you replace x by 2, would it simplify it to y plus 6?
Yes, it would. So if I would have x plus y plus 2, it will give me y plus 4. Okay? Good. So this is basically how we would compute this this integral here. So maybe tomorrow I will come back to this integral and let's make some nice plots and understand how we can see the temperature evolving. And I can just show you how the plot will look like. For example, this would be, if I just run this, do I have the plots here? For example, this would be the kind of plots that we are expecting to get. Okay, sorry, something went wrong. And you would see that the temperature as function of the radius, if we plot this function, would look something like, it's now calculating probably, we can just see how it would look like. Yeah. So you see that this would be, this is a contour plot down here, the temperature as function of the position. You see that the temperature is discontinuous. Here it's zero. Outside it's one, and this is how the temperature would evolve inside the oven. And if you'd like to plot it in a 3D way, this would be the temperature as function of it. And you see that it goes, it's one on one side, and then it decays to the other side, where at the boundary it's zero. And this is how it decays. And this is the profile of the temperature inside the oven. Okay, but we will see how to do this kind of plots, etc., tomorrow, but this is the result of the computation of that integral there, how the temperature evolves here inside.
Would you mind bringing up your question
again? The other one?
Yeah.
Okay, so thank you, and please fill out the surveys before leaving, and leave them in the tables. Yes?
The